Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is pensions and investments editor Tanya Jeffries. And coming up, the Bank of England hikes again. Are we nearly there yet? 100% mortgages, everyone's talking about Skipton's new deal. A good idea or a catastrophe waiting to happen? Listen up as Tanya has some important news on pension credit, and it's the Hollywood drama that you don't want art to imitate life. We tell you how to avoid a succession-style inheritance war with your nearest and dearest. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, rates have been raised again, the 12th time on the bounce, from 4.25 to 4.5 basis points. No great surprise, it was food prices what done it, largely, apparently. But economists and journos less interested in numbers, more in the minutes. So what did the Bank of England think was coming down the line, and how might they respond to it? More rate rises or a reprieve for struggling families? Welcome to you both. Simon, firstly, why the rise? Aren't we feeling enough financial pain already? Was it a good call, a bad call, a pointless call?
So the answer is no. The Bank of England doesn't actually think that we are feeling quite enough pain yet. That is why the Bank of England has raised the base rate, the idea behind which is that it feeds through and increases the cost of borrowing, which lowers demand for borrowing, which slows the volume of money going into the economy from loans being created and the amount of money going around, and drags down inflation. But it's an imprecise tool. It's a lever that you pull and something happens in the future. You don't quite know whether it's going to have the intended effects. And arguably, there is a scenario where if you keep raising interest rates as rapidly as the Bank of England has done over such a short period of time, it's really quite hard to see whether it is working. So we're back to 4.5%, right? That is a level not seen since pre-financial crisis days. It's not that high by historic standards. It's a perfectly reasonable level to have interest rates at. Arguably, many of the problems that we have in the financial system nowadays would not be there had we managed to get back to 4.5% rates after the financial crisis. But we didn't. We sat at near zero rates around the world, every major economy pretty much sitting at near zero, in the UK, which is what we're concerned about, and also the US, which leads the way. US managed to get rates up a bit more post-financial crisis than we did. But hit over here, they sat at very low levels. And we did lots and lots of support for things like lending, funding for lending, encouraging banks to lend, trying to push the banks to lend more money, lend more money, lend more money. And now we're doing the opposite of that because inflation has spiked. And why has inflation spiked? Well, inflation has spiked because of external forces. And the Bank of England can't really control any of that by raising the base rate in the UK and influencing the cost at which people borrow mortgages and businesses borrow. What it's trying to do, though, is not deal with the inflation that we've seen over the last year, that is 10.1% inflation. That's backward looking. That's already happened. It can't do anything about that now because it doesn't have a DeLorean. What it wants to do is make sure that inflation in a year's time, or in 6 months' time, or in 2 years' time, is lower. Now, inflation is forecast to drop quite considerably. So then there comes the question of, well, why is the bank doing this if it genuinely believes, like it keeps saying, and, you know, as everybody keeps saying, that inflation is going to suddenly drop? The answer is they want to be absolutely sure. And it reflects the fact that the economy has so far been more resilient to the sudden and dramatic rise in base rate from 0.1% to 4.5%. It's an astonishing rise, actually, you know, in the context of where it started. The property market's been more resilient. The consumer's been more resilient. My only question with this would be, and I'm saying this as a person who thinks that interest rates should have been raised way before they were, should have been raised after the financial crisis, that we sat on our hands, we were way too timid about this, and we've caused ourselves all kinds of problems with it. My only question would be is whether we've actually really felt the full pain of this yet. I keep coming back to this figure of the number of people who need to remortgage this year. Brilliantly, there are various authorities in the UK that disagree on the actual number. So late last year, the Bank of England said 1.7 million people, households. The ONS says 1.4 million households. So you'll see a number of different figures. Anyway, it's lots of people. But that's just this year. There's loads of people who need to remortgage next year as well. Rates are not going to be considerably lower next year. I mean, unless something goes really badly wrong, rates are not going to be considerably lower next year. So you've got a couple of years of pain coming through here. And I don't think we've even seen the pain that's come through since rates started going up and the spike after the mini budget. I think we're only going to start seeing that pain unfold when people can't afford to keep paying £400 a month more for their mortgage or £300 a month more for their mortgage. It's like there's a bit where their rate goes up, their bills go up, they just keep about manage and keep their heads above water, and then they start to lose the ability to do so, and then they end up in trouble. For most people, it's not a, you know, flip the switch and you go from mortgage rate A one day to mortgage rate B the next day, and all of a sudden you're stuffed. For some people, that is unfortunately the case. But for quite a few people, it will be, well, we'll just have to get by, won't we? Because we've got to keep paying the mortgage. But then it starts to cause some real problems. And then in aggregate, once you start adding all of those people up together, it starts to cause the economy problems. It's going to suck a lot of demand out of the economy, all of those people. And a lot of those people are, you know, there's a third of people who don't have, who own homes and don't even have mortgages. Right. And especially the older generation. Right. It's not a concern for them necessarily. But then there's a chunk of the older generation who do still have mortgages and now have mortgages running into what would have traditionally been their pension years. Their pensions aren't as good as they used to be. They're struggling to keep pace with inflation and they're still trying to pay off their mortgage. Some of them have got interest only mortgages that were dished out in the pre-financial crisis days that are causing them, still causing them real headaches. But then you've got like that big chunk of the population, the home-owning population, the 30s, 40s, early 50s, some late 20s, some, who are really, really facing the pain of this. And a lot of those are the people who drive the economy. So I'm not quite sure that we're out of the woods yet on this, but the Bank of England seems to think that it can keep going with the rate rises and it's not a problem.
Yeah, Tanya, I was talking about this on air and when the news broke about the interest rates going up, and I was doing some number crunching and working out that those on variable mortgages are likely to pay an extra 26 quid extra a month on an average mortgage, which when you add up the 12 rises together is £500 extra a month. And of the however many it is, 1 million to 1.8 million, I've heard people coming off their fixed rate deals are looking at an average extra of £3,000 a year. Now, bearing in mind we are in the middle of a cost of living issue crisis for many, do you agree with Simon? I can't work out those figures. I don't know many people that would have an extra £3,000 in their back pocket just to pay their mortgage on top of all the other issues.
No, they don't, and it is really hard on them. I can speak from personal experience because I had to remortgage and come off my fix this year, and I'm paying an extra £1,000 a year as a result. So not as bad as the people you're talking about, but that is still a serious amount of extra money. Andrew Bailey was interviewed, as he always is, after these interest rate decisions. And it's always really interesting to sort of see the message he's putting out. There is one bit of good news in that they now think that we'll stay out of recession this year, although the GDP figures today were not very good, only up 0.1 percentage points in the first quarter, and March was actually a contraction. So that doesn't actually bode that well for what he was saying. But yet again, it was really clear that he is very worried, as Simon says, about the future of inflation. It's the future of inflation he's concentrating on. And it's wages and prices, wage demands driving up prices even more, and it really setting in as well. And there was an expert on the news last night who made a really good point about the food inflation is the thing that is really worrying them, because it's been so high. What is it, 19%? And it's actually food inflation that is the thing that makes people want their wages to go up. That is the kind of thing that will drive wage demand, because people, you know, can't afford to put food on the table. It's very understandable.
Yeah.
But that is potentially why they're so concerned about inflation setting in, and why they're also so keen to stick to the plan, keep raising rates. You've also got to bear in mind that the ECB and the Federal Reserve are continuing with rate rises at the moment, and you can't get too far out of whack with the other big central banks, because that causes other problems.
Simon, a tough one, I guess, but reading between the lines or the minutes or whatever, have we reached a peak? Are we slowing off? Do you expect maybe another quarter point? But what do you think?
I don't know. There was a suggestion. So last rate rise was March time. There was a suggestion back then that was it. We were done. The peak was, this would be the next one. 4.5% would be the next one. And in fact, they might even stick at 4.25%. This came off the back, actually, of just before the rates decision. There was the banking stuff in the US was unfolding. But then also there was the inflation numbers that had come out that were higher than expected. So there was a push me, pull you scenario going on. I think that if you look at what Andrew Bailey's saying, and if you look at the minutes, and it's also, yesterday was the monetary policy report, it's now called, it used to be called the quarterly inflation report, where the bank lays out all its charts and all its things that it thinks are going to happen. If you look at that, then you would say that rates are going to go up at least one more time and maybe two more times. And markets are now looking at, and you know, 5% as being the peak. But that shifts quite quickly. And you have to bear in mind that just because markets say that, and then the Bank of England uses that chart in its documents, it doesn't mean the Bank of England is actually going to do it. And it's quite often keen stressed, you know, we don't just follow the markets. So I don't know, is the short answer. I think we're nearly there, but whether it's one more or two more, I'm not sure. It's worth noting that out of that vote yesterday for that rate rise, despite all of the concern being expressed about how fast rates have gone up and the full impact on people and whether this is actually filtering through and how people are really feeling the pinch, it was voted through 7-2. So that's a sizable majority. And the two people who didn't vote it through, they wanted to stick at 4.25%. There's nobody on there agitating for cuts at the moment. So you normally see the balance shift a bit more before you start to see the peak. The question is, when will they fall? How long will they stay up there? What you have to bear in mind is that the path of least resistance, even central bank monetary policy committee members are not immune to the classic human behavioral trait of taking the path of least resistance. Mm. And the path of least resistance, having been called out for being too late to tackle inflation and too late to raise rates and all those other things, will be just to leave them relatively high and not start cutting them substantially. So that is the thing that says to me that they're not going to go up, hit that peak, and then suddenly come back down, unless, as I said, something bad happens and it turns out that actually the effects of all of this are really bad. But you know what, the greatest risk actually is that everything's fine. This is a huge risk to the not the greatest risk to people, okay, but the greatest risk to markets at the moment is that everything is fine and that this doesn't cause a problem and that rates do just go back to normal and stay there and that inflation then comes down, but the economy still does okay and everything does okay, because there's a lot of stuff going on in financial markets at the moment that's predicated on the idea that rates go up and then rates are going to come down. So yeah.
Well, what's normal?
Normal?
Yeah. Because actually the average from 19, are you talking about for interest rates? The average from 1971 to 2023 is 7.1, I think.
Yeah, but you've got to take out the outlier periods, haven't you? So
obviously,
what I
like
would say is if you want to know what normal is, you have to take out the bit where it was double digits, you know, and you have to take out the bit where it was nearly zero and then average that bit. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but I reckon it's probably, I reckon normal is like 4 to 5% is normal. Yeah. And that's what, you know, in the old days when I started doing this financial journalism gig, that was rough. That was kind of roughly normal. And then when they fell below 4%, I was like, whoa, that's really low. So, you know, mortgage rates, when my first 5-year fixed rate mortgage was at 4.99%. When I took that out, because that was a really, really good deal for a mortgage, 4.99%. That I think that's, if rates had stayed around about that kind of level, we wouldn't have anywhere near the problem that we have with house prices in this country, which is almost all driven by incredibly cheap money allowing people to keep paying higher and higher prices for houses.
Which leads me nicely onto the question I was going to ask you very briefly, Simon. I mean, mistakes, can we call them mistakes, have been made for now well over a decade that, let's be honest, have shafted a new generation of people trying to get on the property ladder. I mean, that's just one section of society. The people who've got mortgages at the minute were told that this would be manageable, these rises. They're not. I mean, do the Bank of England need to take a really long, hard look at their behaviour, basically?
My suggestion would be what we need to do. We'll talk about the UK because that's where we live, but maybe, you know, this reflects on other countries as well, is we need to get away from the groupthink element that goes on within our financial authorities. And that I think they are staffed by people who are all largely the same, have the same backgrounds, the same... The Bank of the Monetary Policy Committee is made up of very, very senior, very, very clever economists, but they're not a diverse bunch. And it doesn't matter whether they're male or female or neither or black or white or Asian or whatever. That's not the diversity I'm talking about. Talking about the diversity of like education and background and experience. They've all followed it's a very similar path, right? They all kind of think the same. And maybe they don't pay enough attention to what's going on in like normal people land.
Mm.
And I think that's the problem. If you look at the FCA as well, I don't think they pay enough attention to what's going on in normal people land. I think they're quite often behind the curve on what's happening and the problems that emerge. I think it's true of, you know, I think it's true across the kind of financial authorities. And I think maybe if they could kind of find some way to inject a little bit of normal people land into it, and that not just sending out researchers to go interview these strange beasts in normal people land and then come back with some surveys and some data and some things like that, but like actual normal people like involved in the decision making process. I think that basically we would have been in a much better situation if the Monetary Policy Committee in 2021 had featured not just economists but also a builder.
Yeah, I agree. Right, we're going to leave that to one side. Older people struggling to pay bills are being urged to get a pension credit application in now if they want to qualify for the latest cost of living payment. Your claim can even be backdated by 3 months. Just talked there, Tanya, about people struggling, but there is help out there. Cost of living payments, who qualifies?
Well, the government is continuing with its cost of living payments, and quite rightly, in my opinion, because there's a lot of hardship out there. In the current financial year, there's going to be £900 available in three separate instalments, and this is for people on means-tested benefits. There's a whole long list of them, but the ones we've highlighted this week are pensioners who can qualify for pension credit if they're on a really low income. And you can check your eligibility. Our story explaining how to do it is at the top of the pensions page at the moment. So if you think this applies to you or an elderly relative or friend, then that's got all the details of how to do it. But the basic thing you need to know about pension credit is it tops up your income. If you're a single person, to about £201 at the moment, that's just under the full flat rate state pension as it stands. If you're in a couple, it tops it up to £306, £307. You can have a rainy day fund of £10,000 and still qualify. The reason that there's a deadline at the moment, which is why we wrote about it this week, is because there's a 3 month backdating rule. If you got your application in before next Friday and it ended up being successful, it's the application date that matters. It may well take, you know, some time to go through, but if you've applied by next Friday, when it's backdated, you qualify for the first of these three instalments of the cost of living payments, so an extra £301. And that is obviously very valuable to people on the kind of low incomes that we're thinking about. As well as the £900, there's another £150 for people on disability benefits. And also all pensioners are going to get a £300 payment. This is towards help with energy bills, which is obviously, you know, a big issue for older people who need to heat their homes just for health reasons, let alone anything else. And so that's the state of play with cost of living payments. One thing I will say, and we always stress it in these articles that we do about pension credit, is it can be confusing and it can be off-putting, but there is help available to get you through the application process. Age UK runs a free helpline that is in the story that I mentioned, the number for that, and their staff will have a look at all the things you might be eligible for, not just pension credit, but other things as well to do with your health, your caring responsibilities and so on. And with pension credit, they will help you get through the application. You can also, if you've got an elderly relative who needs help, you can help them too. But that is a really valuable service for the elderly. I think it's well worth ringing them because they will talk to you about eligibility and whether it is even worth you doing this. There's also an online tool that you can use to check you're eligible so you know whether it's worthwhile. But Age UK will help and talk you through it and then get through the process. There were backlogs at the end of last year. We're not hearing so much about that recently. When there are problems, we tend to hear via Steve Webb's pensions questions inbox. That's not to say there aren't going to be delays if you apply for pension credit. But the crucial thing is, for this cost of living payment, is the date on the application. And that is what we were flagging up. So you've still got a week. It's well worth looking into this if you or somebody you care about in your family or a friend might benefit from this.
Fantastic advice. Thank you very much, Tanya. That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. And is it welcome back to the 100% mortgage, the ones without a guarantor required? Skipton have launched a new product to help renters get on the property ladder. What on earth could possibly go wrong, Simon Lambert? Some historical context. What are 100% mortgages? Different types? How common are they? How do they work? Etc.
100% mortgage is a mortgage where you don't need to put down a deposit. Usually when you get a mortgage, what happens is you put a deposit down against the property, and that can be of a varying amount, and it's measured by percentage. So for example, if you were buying a £200,000 home, I was going to use the example of a £100,000 one, but they're quite hard to find nowadays. If you were buying a £200,000 home and you put down a 10% deposit, then that would be £20,000. You would then be buying at something known as 90% loan to value. So these two things flip around. You talk about 10% deposits and then loan to values, which is how much the mortgage is as a percentage of the value of the property. Now, the obvious problem for first-time buyers is that as house prices rise, the monetary amount that it takes to build up your percentage deposit gets larger and larger. And due to the magnifying effect involved, that gets larger and larger at a far faster rate than most people can save money. So in the scenario where once upon a time you used to be able to buy your first property for £100,000 and you needed a 10% deposit, you only needed £10,000. Now you need £20,000 for your £200,000 property. And it's a lot harder to save £20,000 than it is £10,000. unless your wages rise at the same pace as those property prices are rising. Wages have not risen at the same rate that property prices have risen. So raising a deposit is the biggest hurdle for most first-time buyers, which is where the bank of mum and dad comes in. Lots of people get given money by their parents, given money by their grandparents. It's why lots of people just can't buy by themselves anymore. They have to buy as a couple or with friends or with family. And it's a real problem. And actually, it's a great problem for many people who are struggling to raise that deposit and save the money, you know, who are renting, because in many cases, due to the fact that interest rates are relatively low, they're much higher now than they were, but they're relatively low. There are scenarios where they'd actually be paying less on the mortgage than they are in rent every month, but they can't get a mortgage and they can't buy the property because they can't save that deposit, and they are not in the fortunate position of having the bank of mum and dad or the bank of anything or anything else to call on and get that money. So that's where the 100% mortgage idea comes in. Basically, what you do is you enable these people to get onto the property ladder and to buy their own home, and then their money is at least going towards paying off their mortgage, only ever so slightly in the early years of a mortgage, because in the early years of a mortgage, most of your money is going on interest, and then you start chipping away at the debt and chipping away at the debt and chipping away at the debt, and that starts paying down the property. Now, the concern over 100% mortgages is that you have no buffer. So the deposit that you put down when you buy a property, if you put down £20,000, well, if house prices go up, your quid's in, because if the average house price goes from £200,000 to £220,000, it's gone up by 10%, but you only put 20 grand in. You've doubled your money. Woohoo! You can see why people love buying property and looking at how much they've made on it, can't you? And why buy-to-let's so attractive to people. If, however, house prices go down by 20%, then your entire deposit has been wiped out. So, and that's your buffer. And the problem is if your deposit has been wiped out, it doesn't matter as long as you don't need to move. If you need to move, then you've got a problem because you now no longer have any equity in your property. And so you can't go buy another one. And if the house price keeps falling below the level of the deposit that you've put in, you end up in something called negative equity, which is a really unfortunate position that some people end up in sometimes, which is where basically their house is now worth less than the mortgage that they owe on it. And in this country, you don't get to just hand back the keys and walk away. You are on the hook for that mortgage, even if your home is now worth less than the mortgage. If you have put down no deposit, then there is no buffer. So the slightest fall in house prices and you are in negative equity. And actually, really, I guess if you factor in the costs of buying, like the surveyor's stuff, like the conveyancing work, the legal work, all those other things, you are actually almost, you're instantly down, you know, on it. But 100% mortgages became so controversial because they boomed pre-financial crisis. They were a feature of the pre-financial crisis years, and actually more than 100% mortgages, the 125% mortgage, the Northern Rock Together mortgage, where Northern Rock would not only lend you 100% of the property, it would then give you an extra loan on top of that of up to 25% of the property's value to cover like other costs and stuff. So you were instantly in negative equity. And the problem was that was fine when house prices were going up at a fair clip, but when house prices started falling, and also when interest rates went up and people couldn't remortgage off these deals, people ended up stuck. There are some people who took out Northern Rock Together mortgages who are still on the hook for them. There are some people who have only just got off the hook for them. I know somebody who was in that position, and it hampered her financially for the next, I don't know how many years it is since Northern Rock collapsed, but it was only until very recently that she actually managed to get out of that one. So what's the going on here? Why skipped and suddenly launched 100% mortgage?
Yep.
Because we're back in the position where people are paying more on rent than they would be on a mortgage. People struggle to raise the deposit, and Skipton wants to help people get onto the property ladder and has said that it will take into account It's called the track record mortgage, and it will take into account their track record of continuing to pay their bills and meet their bills, and the crucial example being their rent, basically. So as long as they've been keeping up with their rent and they've shown themselves to be a good buyer, they'll be limited on how much they can borrow, and then they will be able to try to get 100% mortgage with Skipton, and they'll be able to get onto the property ladder.
I'll go into slightly more detail, but just out of the goodness of their hearts, they're doing this. I mean, there's not a financial benefit for Skipton here. I mean, not to be cynical, and I'm not saying that, but do you know what I mean? Like, it's a bit rare hearing, you know, a bank or building society is doing something just for the good of those renters that can't get on. No, I don't believe that.
Clearly, Skipton is not a charitable organisation. Okay, so yes, for all of the mortgage brokers who have hailed this as a masterstroke, revolutionary, or a real helping hand to people who were stuck in the rental trap and everything else like that, you do need to remember that Skipton is in the business of making money. It is a building society, so it is owned by its members, effectively by the customers of Skipton Building Society. The boss of Skipton Building Society does get paid quite a lot of money. The senior people at Skipton Building Society do get paid quite a lot of money, and in order to continue to be paid quite a lot of money, they would like Skipton Building Society to continue to make quite a lot of money. There has been an obvious slowdown in the mortgage market, so you can see why they might have stepped in here.
Yeah,
I mean, I quote my colleague, Helen Crane, Skipton is hardly doing its customers a favour. Where was its 100% loan back in 2021 when the housing market was going great guns and first-time buyers armed with lockdown savings were clamouring to get in on the action? Back then, most lenders took their first-time buyer mortgages off the market or put the rates up to such giddy heights that they may as well have done. People with small deposits of only 5 or 10% were too high risk in those COVID times, and with middle-class pandemic movers banging down their doors to mortgage their huge new homes in the countryside, lenders frankly didn't need them. But today, lenders do need first-time buyers, so much so they're willing to lend them the entire price of their property to hook them in. It's something that hasn't been offered since the financial crisis. Just think about that for a second. And I think Helen makes a very good point there.
Yeah.
You know, why? You know, there is the why now question, but there is also the scenario where it's really difficult, this one, because on one hand, you've got the hang on a minute, it smells a bit fishy, we want to be a bit careful about this. And then on the other hand, you've got the, well, on the personal level,
yeah,
if I was in the position of renting and I knew even with these high mortgage rates now that I could go buy a property and I'd be paying a couple of £100 or less every month on the mortgage, and I'd be thinking, well, this would be great for me. You've got to remember that properties come with costs. You know, when you're renting, the landlord pays all the maintenance and all those other things.
Yeah.
You know, so you do have to factor that in.
Look, before I get to the risk, Tanya, because I do want to know what your gut instinct tells you about these sorts of mortgages. But, okay, getting a deposit is a huge battle. The other is the multiple of earnings of which a mortgage lender will lend to you. Now, I did, you know, back of the stamp kind of calculations here. The average wage, I think, is around about £33,000. The average house price is about £300,000. Now, Skipton will lend 4.49 times your earnings. So by 4.49 times the average wage is half the average house. Now, if you live down south, you will be laughing if you think the average house price is £300,000 or anywhere near London or a big city. That, to me, is one of the big issues. I mean, obviously there are other issues related to this 100% mortgage, which we'll get into, as I said, but it's the multiple of earnings as well that is not going to help people. I mean if you're a single person particularly.
Yes, I think it's nine times now. Average house prices are nine times average salary. And yes, you're right. I mean, first time buyers are going to be looking at the cheapest property out there because they're just starting out, so not the average property, the averagely priced property. This is a really tough one. I have loads of sympathy with renters who really want to get on the housing ladder. And it's not just about having a place of your own. It's getting away from the whole grind of landlords. They're constantly putting up your rent. They're being difficult. or they're selling and they're moving you on. When in my renting days, one of the worst things was constantly having to move. People would always find a reason. They'd sell, or they'd have problems with paying their mortgage, or they'd do this, that and the other. And I moved on average every 10 months. And you just want an end to that. Because of my sympathy for renters, I'm a bit more inclined to give this one a fair look. And maybe I'm going to be a bit contrarian here. Take aside the fact that Skipton are not doing this out of the goodness of their own heart. That's their business. They're in business. If you are in this position, they've designed it quite carefully so that you do have to be quite a responsible person with your finances, and they won't let your mortgage payments go higher than your current rent payments, which is quite an important safeguard. You have to look at your situation, though. Yes, there is definitely, I mean, negative equity is terrible. But if you can stay in the home and you're in the kind of job where you're not likely to lose your job. I mean, in the private sector, you could always lose your job. But there are a lot of people who are teachers and nurses and so on, where, you know, they have got some kind of job security. Negative equity is still a major problem because you can't remortgage, you know, you might not be able to move. It's still a serious risk. But if you think that you could weather it because you're going to carry on having an income and you've got a partner who's got an income as well, then you're in a bit of a safer position. Clearly, if you can afford to scrape together a deposit, it is much better to do that than go for 100% mortgage. I'm not saying that. I think if you're part of the way there or nearly there already, then it's worth hanging on rather than jumping for this. But you have to weigh up your own situation before you dismiss this out of hand. I mean, Helen is quite right in everything she says. And she's a really high information renter. She really knows a lot about the property market. Most people don't, unfortunately. It's a really tough one. I would struggle with it if I was in this position. And also, the people who are going to be doing this are the ones that don't have parents that are going to bung them a load of money. So that is another reason that I'm massively sympathetic to people who might be considering this kind of deal. Go into it with your eyes open.
Really. Indeed. Speak to a broker, all that sort of thing. Speak to family and friends. I wasn't criticizing Skipton there. I just wanted to say that I do appreciate they're a business doing business. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't going, oh, look, aren't they being really great to renters? Because, as I said, they are a business. Or as you guys said, they are a business.
I would say, on that note, I would say fair play to them for putting their head above the parapet. They've thought it out properly. Things like limiting it to how much rent you're paying every month and stuff like that. I think you just need to remember that the mortgage might be capped at your maximum rent, but if you own a property, you're on the hook for all the other stuff. What happens when you buy it and then the boiler packs up? What happens when you know something else goes wrong? You just need to factor in the fact that and just the maintenance costs of a property every year. You know, you need to factor in that it's going to cost you an extra couple of £100 a month at least on top of that mortgage for stuff that you just don't realize that your landlord's picking the tab up for in many cases when you rent.
I don't think my landlord's doing much, to be fair, but I am so good as a tenant. Yeah. There's nothing going on.
Can I say one more thing, though, on the 100% mortgage thing?
That's fine. I was going to ask you something else. All
right. No, go on.
Three more things. No, if it's just Simon, you crack on, because it might be the question I was going to ask you anyway.
Okay. So if you're tempted to do this, I think there's just one thing you need to bear in mind. Well, there's a number of things you need to bear in mind. We've just talked about most of them. But one of the things I would bear in mind is that there is a very strong case to be made for house prices potentially falling substantially from here. Yeah. 10%, 20%, right? And what you need to understand is that if that happens, you're going to have a problem if you bought with 100% mortgage. You have a problem if you bought with 5 or 10% and they fall 20%. But you will have a problem. So as Tanya said, you need to make sure that you would be able to stay in that property, you know, to see that out. So you need to think of it like when people say about investing, it's for the long term. It's 5-year minimum time horizon. If you're going to do this, I would be thinking 5-year minimum time horizon in order to ride out the potential risks that are involved there. And the chief reason why there's the potential for house prices to fall perhaps 20% from here, is because the vast majority of people need a mortgage in order to buy a property. Mortgage rates are substantially higher now than they were. So the average five-year fixed rate is now about 5%. You can get cheaper rates than that, but the average five-year fix is about 5%. If you go back to 2020, like pre-pandemic, it was about 2%. If you look at the, I'm going to stick these charts in the podcast article when I publish it on This Is Money. So if anybody wants to see this, come back and look at this, you know, later today, Friday. So come back late, you know, Friday evening, Saturday morning, and see the story. I'll stick the nationwide charts in here because they illustrate it really well. Okay, we need to understand that at the moment, even though they have fallen from the peak compared to earnings, house prices are very, very high compared to earnings. And that is like almost as high as they were at the peak pre-financial crisis. They rose above that recently. That has been enabled by very, very low mortgage rates. Those very, very low mortgage rates don't exist anymore. If you go back to April 2020, on the nationwide charts, average house price was around about £210,000 to £220,000. It's currently about £260,000, right? Now, mortgage rates now, the best mortgages that you can get are about 4%. Back then, the best mortgages you could get on a five-year fix were about 1.4%. So even the best buyers with the biggest possible deposits are paying an order of magnitude more on their mortgage rates than they were back then. And people have not got richer, substantially richer, since that point in time. The only thing that enabled house prices to go up so much after that was very, very cheap mortgage rates. They don't exist anymore. Not only do they not exist anymore, they're much, much higher. So that's what you need to understand about the risks involved in the housing market at the moment, and therefore the risks of taking out the 100% mortgage. And if you fully understand all of those, and you are thinking long term, and you're still willing to go ahead with it, and you think it's right for you, and it works out personally, knock yourself out, right? I'm not saying that it's a bad choice for any individual. I can't give individual personal financial advice, and I wouldn't deem to tell someone what they should do in their own personal financial situation, because everyone's is different. But just be aware of the risks. And I would say the same thing with any risky thing that anybody was doing with their money. Know the risks, go into it with your eyes open.
Fantastic advice, as always, Simon. Finally, if you haven't been watching Succession, you're missing out. You are not missing out, however, on the confusion and wranglings over inheritance going on in the hit TV show. But with more disputes heading to the courts, we thought we'd give you a guide on how to avoid your own Hollywood-style drama. I'm not sure who to go to here, because I'm not sure if anybody's been watching this. Has anybody been watching Succession? Can you explain to the dear listeners what they are missing out on? Look, I'll be honest with you, it's for me, like, I think it's Simon who's going to take this one. Tanya's pointing there wildly. For me, I got caught up with it, Simon, but I have no commitment. And with American dramas like this, I think they speak too quickly. I can't keep up. So I don't know what's happening. So I think I got through about, I don't know, just before the first series. So I am actually missing out. Am I?
Yeah, you are missing out. All Succession right. is marvelous. It is really good. Like the interplay, the dialogue, some of the lines are incredible. And you're just missing out on watching Kieran Culkin, who is just absolutely brilliant.
He is marvelous.
He is magnificent in it. Also, if only because you can flick back to Home Alone and see him in that and then go, ha-ha, how funny. Succession is great. Succession, though, isn't a drama about inheritance tax.
No.
It's a drama about a media empire and who gets to take over at the in the media empire. So it's a bit of a leap, really, but you know,
we like a nice hook, so it's fine.
We like a nice picture.
Well, exactly, you know, so it's good for SEO or something, search engine optimization, right? But either way, be that as a stretch or not, it has got something to do with inheritance, I'm sure, in there. You've been looking at ways to avoid having a Hollywood-style drama. Tanya, firstly, inheritance tax is becoming more of a thing, isn't it? I mean, it's becoming more of a thing. It's also becoming more of a thing in courts.
Well, yeah, it's to do with the property market that we've just been talking about. More and more people are becoming liable for it, and the rates are the thresholds are frozen until 2028. So more and more people are going to have to pay it, and that's a lot more families who are going to have to wrestle with that, and all the other things attached to inheritance, not least the emotional side. What you do with the family home, and so on. So the person who wrote this article is Ian Dial, who is an estate planning expert from Evelyn Partners. He has written many pieces for us over the years and answered lots of reader questions. He is absolutely excellent at this kind of thing. He's clearly a succession watcher. And while he has some disparaging things to say about Logan Roy and his approach to how he deals with his children, and suggests you do not take that approach, he thinks that most parents want to, you know, help their children get through the inheritance issues as smoothly as possible. And he is here with some very valuable, well thought out advice. He's got many years of experience giving it, so he's worth listening to. The piece again is at the top of the pensions page if people want to go and check it out. But the first thing he says is talk to your family, tell them your wishes. A lot goes wrong in families where unexpected things happen after an inheritance starts playing out. Also, it sounds obvious, but the will is very important. Make sure it's valid. Don't make silly mistakes with it, and keep records of your assets. He says that's very important. Keep a list of your assets with your will, because that really helps sort things out. As far as inheritance tax goes, he does talk about gifting within your lifetime and runs through the rules on that. When it comes to the family home, this is a really tricky one, especially with so many. We had figures from the ONS this week about how many more adult children now live with their parents for so much longer. And there can often be problems over the family home, especially if one sibling has been staying at home, perhaps devoting years caring for a parent. And should that be taken account of in the will? We've had quite a few reader questions about this kind of thing over the years. And one of the things that the legal experts always say is, going back to communication, tell people your plans. If you are going to favour one of your children and give them more, or have special conditions attached to the way the family home is dealt with because of what they've done for you over the years, then tell all the others in advance and make it all really clear. Lay it down in the will. Get the solicitor to help you achieve what you want to achieve on that front, because we do unfortunately hear from people, and also always in the comments section with inheritance stories, there's so many people who say, I haven't spoken to my siblings since my parents died. We fell out so badly over it. It's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. If you want to prevent that kind of thing happening and you can see tensions, just signal it all way in advance. The final thing that Ian suggests is sort out what is going to happen to your pension separately from all of this. You need to make sure that you nominate somebody, because it's sorted out separately in a lot of cases. So make sure that's up to date. One of the things that lawyers always say is get that kind of thing up to date. You don't want your previous wife or husband getting your pension rather than your current partner.
Indeed, I know a case of that one.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Thank you very much, Simon. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcasts past and join in the debate in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.